Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
New Hampshire is the Granite State. We like our landscapes and our people to be tough. But New Hampshire is also known for its beauty, our forests and mountains, our trails, fields, and cold water coastline. What this state isn't known for are its islands. But today, we're changing that. I'm Peter Biello. This is a special from New Hampshire Public Radio. Instead of the Exchange's weekly news roundup, with the end of summer rapidly approaching, we are dedicating the next hour entirely to the islands of New Hampshire. We've got stories from the seacoast and the lakes region to the North Country. Stories of camps, boats, warring lobstermen, and inescapable beauty. There will be, of course, some island music, and we're going to start our radio vacation on Lake Winnipesaukee. It's home to some of the state's best islands. It's also where, for more than a century, the U.S. Postal Service has operated a unique mail route. The Sophie C., a 74-foot motorboat, is the oldest floating mail service in the country. NHPR's Paige Sutherland climbed aboard and has our story.
The Sophie C. sits at a pier at Weir's Beach, bearing the U.S. Postal Service's soaring eagle on its starboard side. As the red, white, and blue vessel revs up to begin the morning mail run, Postmaster Annie Nix finishes sorting the mail, something she's done every summer for 18 years. But for Nix, this is more than just a job.
I have a log cabin on Bear Island. My family have been residents of Bear Island since the late 1800s.
Nix is now 64 and has never missed a summer on the lake. She's watched the island families grow up and knows most by first and last names.
Sophie is the island boat. Everybody likes to see Sophie. When you're a young child, even on the southern end of Bear Island, we would watch her go by when she was doing her mail service, and she would always toot to the island people. And it was like you could tell the time of day when you're on the island when Sophie went past.
Sophie was built specifically for the lake in 1969 in South Boston. She's named after the owner's wife, Sophie Caroline. Every day, except Sundays, she visits 8 islands on Winnipesaukee, and each island has a different feel. As Nix ties up to the dock at Three Mile Island, a shirtless Bob Armstrong comes to greet her. He's 69 and has been coming to this camp since he was a kid.
And we come up this particular week because many of our friends that we got to know when we were 4 and came to camp every summer are still coming here. And we now all know each other's kids. We've watched each other get cancer and get divorced and remarried.
Approaching the next stop, Annie Nix grabs 3 large bags. They're full of packages, mostly from Amazon, for the kids at the YMCA summer camps on Camp Lawrence Island. The person in charge of lugging all these up to the cabins is camp manager Bruce Corsetti.
Howdy, Bruce.
How you doing?
Good.
I've been out in the sun too long, being marooned on an island. You go crazy.
Bruce has a tradition. He sports a different outfit each time he comes and picks up the mail.
Well, I wear a pink shirt with rabbits. I got hot chili peppers all over my shorts. And I'm wearing a chef's hat on a hot, sunny day.
Then it's off to Birch Island.
Au revoir.
Bye.
Bonne chance. Bye. Have a good time.
As the boat pulls up, islanders mingle as they wait for their mail. Sally Small has been coming to Birch Island for 68 years. Back in the day, there was enough mail for 2 daily boat routes.
Well, when I was a kid, I told you, we had 10 o'clock mail boat, and then we could play, had to go home for lunch, had to take a nap after lunch, and then we could meet back up at 3 o'clock for mail boat, and then play again. So it was, we lived by the mail boat.
After all the mail is delivered, the Sophie C. is off, but not without a traditional island send-off. The kids climb up onto these tall pillars and jump off into the boat's wake. Annie remembers seeing their parents doing the same thing years ago. As the clock approaches 3:30, it's time for Sophie's last stop of the day, Jolly Island. Michaela Curley and her husband Michael are on the dock waiting to get some ice cream for their son Barry. Michaela remembers many summers with the mailboat growing up.
When I was in 8th grade, I got a letter, a love letter, and not for Michael, but it was like the coolest thing ever.
With Annie Nix's unique postal route done for the day, the Sophie C heads back to Weir's Beach, but there will be more deliveries the next day and for as long as it's summer on the lake.
NHPR's Paige Sutherland.
How on ye, island of love, lovely princess of the islands.
One of the Sophie C's stops, as we heard, is Three Mile Island. Its name comes from the approximate distance from Center Harbor. This island is owned and operated by the Appalachian Mountain Club, and it's changed very little since it first opened as a campground in the year 1900. People of all ages come for a week or two and enjoy nature, swimming, reading, and meals served family style at the main lodge. Let's listen in on what a day and night are like on Three Mile Island.
That's cool. You get to come to Three Mile Island, one of the best places in the world, for 24 hours.
I'm Neil Burns. I've been coming to Three Mile since...
My name's Sally Wilson.
1968.
Since 1965. Basically, this island, from when I was a kid, I mean, I can walk around this island pretty much without a flashlight because I've been here so long, and nothing really changes.
Nothing changes much?
The parents talk. People read. The kids play. And that's the way it's always been.
Hello, my name is Colin Bradley. I'm the island educator, or the naturalist for Three Mile Island, and we are about to begin week 6, Capture the Flag.
My name is Will Holmes, and I'm the manager of Three Mile Island Camp. The layout of the island is that it's a 43-acre space.
It's a very rustic place.
And there are 50 camper cabins around the perimeter of the island.
Sure, I'm Beagle Burgo. You know, you stay in these cabins that don't have electricity. There's no flush toilets, so they're outhouses. So that's very appealing for some people because it is very different, and for other people, it's just not what they want to do. So
the technology policy is you can use technology, but we ask people to do it in their cabins.
Yes, of course. I'm Violet Mendoza, Philadelphia. It's a little bit hard to get used to for the first day, but then once you let it completely go and you really don't even miss it.
People are doing activities with other people who they maybe have known for 50 years, or maybe they met yesterday.
It's a big, big, big fish.
It's a largemouth.
I didn't catch it. He caught it.
But if you ever catch a small fish, but don't eat it.
2.5 pounds.
It's 2 pounds. Yeah. I think it was almost about 2 pounds.
Everything centers around mealtime. It sort of brings us all together.
Some people call it Three Meal Island.
Food's pretty good.
Pesto chicken, tortellini, and mushrooms. And Adaro. It's my 3rd year on crew, but my 1st year in the kitchen.
My name's Rory Lowe. I'm the crew boss at Three Mile Island Camp.
I'm Autumn Welling, and I'm from Jacksonville, Florida.
I'm 21 years old.
Whoa. Some of the things I do as a crew member.
Well, you work the meals, and between those,
we'll chop wood for an hour or two.
Paint cabins and clean the bathrooms, scrub the kitchen.
It's really just whatever needs to get done.
It's long days, and it's definitely hustling, but that's what's so good about it, just being busy.
Chris Staley, State College, Pennsylvania. Well, since I was, first time I came, I was like 6, so that's 56 years ago. So there's a slowness. So every day seems like a reshuffling of slow time that you don't get in our day-to-day lives very often.
Yeah, I think the restriction here becomes physical. You know, at some point you can't move around on the rocks and the trails and in and out of boats. And I think that happens to some people at different ages, but you know, it's sort of sad when that happens. But people sometimes know it and they say, this is my last time. It does happen, you can see it.
Holly Tangway from Gloucester, Massachusetts. It's hard, you bond well with people, so it's a challenge to say goodbye to them. It's a big challenge to say goodbye to the island, because you're going back to your more complicated life. And even though I live in a beautiful place, it's still, you know, the place where all my obligations are. I'm always nostalgic. I'm looking back at the island on the boat as I leave, waving to 3 Mile.
That was sound from 3 Mile Island on Lake Winnipesaukee. New Hampshire has something like 270 different named islands. There are 5 called Big Island, though curiously, there is no Small Island. There is a Sheep Island, an Eagle Island, a Goat Island, and in true New Hampshire fashion, there are 10 different places called Loon Island. In the Androscoggin River in Berlin, New Hampshire, there is an 8-mile-long chain of islands that poke up out of the water almost like a spine. It has perhaps the strangest name of them all. Todd Bookman went to Berlin to learn more.
Barry Kelly is driving around his land in Berlin. He's like a safari guide stalking a rhino.
We can go through this field, and there's a spot down there where we should be able to see some piers. Let's try that.
He's coursing through a savanna of waist-high grass just east of the Androscoggin River.
You're just making the road up as you go?
Yeah, no, it's all pretty solid.
Kelly is in an untucked Hawaiian shirt, his gray hair catching the breeze.
That's one right there covered with trees. That aisle. And there's another one.
He's the owner of White Mountain Lumber Company, a sawmill that dates to 1945. These islands he's pointing out go back much further. They're called the Boom Piers.
And now I'm here with Todd to tell you a little story that you'd like to hear about the Boom Piers.
First, introduce yourself.
Okay, my name is Paul Puff Tardif.
Puff is a big man in jean shorts, a local historian and writer for the Berlin Daily Sun. He's a friend of Barry Kelly, and like Kelly, he grew up here. The story starts in the 1890s, a time when lumber and pulpwood defined this city. Mills lined both sides of the river. They were hungry for all the trees being harvested north of town.
The way to get their product here was to put the wood in the water and float it down here.
The annual river drives. Kelly remembers seeing these as a kid.
The river driving, of course, was done in the spring at the highest water levels. The wood would be cut in the fall and the winter, and then brought out on the ice, and when the ice melted, the wood was in the water.
Each spring, hundreds of thousands of cords were sent down the Androscoggin.
As a matter of fact, there were so many logs in the river, you couldn't throw a line in to fish.
But all that wood needed to be sorted because it had different owners. Big players like the Brown Company and International Paper needed to access what was theirs. In the 1890s, they came up with a plan.
They had to divide the river because they both had the right to use it. So they built these islands of rock out of hemlock framing and divided the river.
Big rectangles, maybe 10 feet across, that were filled in with rocks.
How did they get all those rocks there? It had to be one heck of a job.
When they were finished, the pier stood like a row of traffic cones, cones that stretched north for 8 miles, all the way up to Milan, where the wood was sorted.
And when they were built, they had chains hooked to big long logs from one pier to the other, and those logs were called booms. So that's where we get the name Boom Piers.
The Boom Piers of Berlin. Something like 90 or 95 of these chained together rocky islands, built every few hundred feet or so, depending on the depth of the Androscoggin. One company could now send its wood down the left lane, the other down the right lane. Other mills, like Barry Kelly's own family sawmill, could also use these lanes. It was like an organized highway. But by the early 1960s, the economics of river driving, of sending wood down the water, shifted.
When did they stop driving the river?
They stopped driving the river in 63, was the last cleanup drive. And they stopped because trucks were more efficient then, roads were better. There was a loss factor. Pulpwood would sink, some of it. So the bottom of this river is covered with pulpwood.
According to Puff Tardif, the last still floating log was pulled from the Androscoggin in November of 1964. The boom piers since then have been left to the elements. Most of the hemlock surrounding them has drifted away. But the rocky centers still poke up through the water.
We got one up here that's got a nice American flag on it. Makes it look good.
The boom piers still help give this city its shape.
That was NHPR's Todd Bookman. After the break, we head to the seacoast for more island stories. This is NHPR.
I'm Virginia Prescott, here to tell you that after 8-plus years, word of mouth is ending its run as a weekday show. But I am thrilled to announce a revamped, retooled, and relaunched word of mouth weekend show beginning September 2nd. From now on, we are going local, answering your questions about the state and exploring the culture, history, and geography of the place we call home. Listen in to the new Word of Mouth, Saturdays at 11, right after Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NHPR.
Welcome back. I'm Peter Biello. Today, a special from New Hampshire Public Radio on the state's islands. These days, we think of islands as places to get away, to slow down, sip a cocktail on the beach. But historically, islands have often served another purpose— as a place to put people you don't want to have around. Think Alcatraz. Off the coast of Portsmouth, there are islands that were once used for that purpose. As Todd Bookman found out, the people who were stuck there sometimes figured out novel ways to entertain themselves.
In Portsmouth in the late 18th century, epidemics were the norm, and smallpox among the worst.
Oh, smallpox was a terror.
This is Rebecca Noel, a history professor at Plymouth State University.
It was one of the great terrors that parents could have for their children, that adults could have. It's one of those diseases that you can only have once. If you survive it, you're good to go. But a lot of people wouldn't survive it.
No matter how bad you think smallpox must have been, it was far worse. For the first 10 to 14 days, you don't have symptoms.
And then you start to feel really sick. Terrible headaches, backaches, vomiting, misery.
And then came the pustules, the pox. They start forming all over your body and then turn into scabs.
The scabs can be so intense that you can stick to your mattress and not be able to turn over without losing all of the side of your body. It's really a horrible disease. It's not something anybody would want to live through just to be immune.
A horrible disease. And one that had basically no effective treatments in the 18th century. You kind of just had to gut it out. But as R. Stuart Wallace, historian with NHTI in Concord, explains, there was an inoculation.
These inoculations were basically a means of giving you a small case of smallpox in the hopes that you'd get through it okay after 2, 3, 4 weeks, and that having been seasoned, you'd never get it again.
To perform these inoculations, doctors would take a small amount of fluid from inside of a smallpox pustule. They would then make an incision on a healthy person and insert the fluid. It was mostly effective.
The only snag was that small case of smallpox still got you very sick, and in some cases, it could even kill you.
But with few other options in the 18th century, people were willing to take the risk. The problem was, after getting inoculated, you were contagious. And so patients were often sent to something called a pest house.
Okay, so a pest house really is just a fancy name for a small hospital building.
It's a place where, usually in a town, many towns had them, where they would take ill individuals or sometimes whole families and put them in a separate house.
Towns had to be strategic about where they located their pest houses.
You want to be able to manage who's coming and going. You want to be very aware of bringing supplies in and bringing anything out. And so it really helps to have it on an island.
A pest island. Off of Portsmouth in the late 18th century, different little specks of land would be used at different times for just this purpose. People would be sent there to receive their smallpox inoculations.
So the doctor would come and he would inoculate the people who were there. The people would come through in what was called classes. For a month at a time, it would be the same 80 people or the same 20 people or whatever.
These classes would get their inoculations and then stay on the island, completely isolated, for the next 4 or so weeks. And you know, this probably sounds pretty terrible. You were, in effect, quarantined. You knew that you were going to be very sick, and there was this chance that you would still die from the smallpox inoculation. But there's also this other thing to keep in mind.
There were people in this isolated environment
co-ed, very often co-ed.
Young men and young women rarely got to be alone like this, away from their parents and their pastors.
They were more free to virtually any activities that they wanted.
And remember, after getting the inoculation, you didn't start getting sick for 10 to 14 days.
So they would have a couple of fun weeks, I think, where they would, you know, party and talk to each other. And there aren't that many opportunities in the 18th century to be just isolated with the opposite sex and, you know, making friends and so on.
In other words, rampant promiscuous sex.
Well, probably not that. But still, there are letters from this period that describe smallpox parties on Pest Island. A well-known Portsmouth historian named Charles Brewster wrote about these good times.
That little green isle in the Piscataqua,
whose still life at the present day is disturbed only by its few inhabitants,
was for a time a scene of great animation. The flower of youth and beauty of Portsmouth were congregated there,
and remembered the affair as little else than a holiday festival of the gayest description.
Brewster writes about how one evening, the flower of youth on Pest Island threw a candy party. They had somehow gotten their hands on a vat of molasses. The residents would play pranks on each other. They went out for evening strolls. All in all, a pretty wild scene, for the first part of your stay at least.
Because once you get sick, it's kind of miserable.
By the turn of the 19th century, both the misery and the merriment would draw to an end. A true vaccine for smallpox was introduced, one that didn't require a quarantine. The smallpox parties of Portsmouth were over. But Pest Island? That's actually still a place. Though a number of different islands were called Pest over the decades, today's Pest Island is just west of Newcastle in the Piscataqua River. It's about 10 acres, depending on the tide, no houses, no residents, just scraggly brush and a seaweed-covered shoreline. But up in a clearing, you'll find a campsite, a fire pit, a stray beer can. Pest Island is still clearly a place where people come to isolate themselves and throw a little party.
Well, all we need is an island, big old sandy beach, palm tree for some shade.
There is a certain feeling you get on an island, water all around. It's a particular kind of solitude. Our next story is about that experience. NHPR reporter Sean Hurley went to visit the winter caretaker of Star Island back in 2015, and as you'll hear, he struggled just to reach her.
On our first attempt to leave the harbor for Star Island, the muffler was frozen, and the Miss Julie, a 29-foot lobster boat, wouldn't start. On our second try, the impeller broke and the engine overheated. Sailors are superstitious, and if anything goes wrong this time, Brad Anderson jokes, he might have to toss me overboard.
You might be bad luck.
Is it me?
It might be you.
Anderson makes surfboards in York, Maine. He's also the land-based half of Star Island's winter caretaking team. Every few weeks, he makes this 9-mile journey to visit his partner, Alexandra DeSteiger.
Bring supplies, water, food. Yeah, but fundamentally, she's out there by herself most of the time.
Anderson and DeSteiger first met as tall ship crewmates. And Anderson recalls even then, she was taking pictures of the sea.
She's been a photographer for 28 years, probably, but she didn't really do much on the business side of art to actually get seen more and get people to know her work.
DeSteiger's reticence and preference for solitude meant that her art went largely unseen for years. But after self-publishing Small Island, Big Picture, a collection of her photographs in 2013, the world got its first real glimpse of her work.
You know, at some point, someone's going to notice and realize how remarkable what she's doing is.
Around us, the sharp water crackles with light, and the snow-white islands seem to rise from the waves. The DeSteiger meets me on the ice-clad dock in a green army jacket and blue jeans and leads me over the snow to her caretaker's house.
It's got everything for me. It's got surrounded by the sea. It's rocky and rugged. I feel like I'm a northern girl. You know, I need to feel like I'm suffering somewhat. I just feel more alive that way.
She outlines the significant chapters of her life. First, as a girl wandering through the swamp beside her house.
I remember some days I would, like, the project for the day would be to pack a lunch and head out and try to get lost. That would be my, you know, big hope.
As she grew older, she wanted to get lost in something Vaster.
I just had this big romance with the sea, and I always wanted to sail on a ship.
When she turned 18, she signed up for a course of study on a tall ship. She met Brad Anderson, and for the next 9 years, they were sailors.
Do you think you would have come to photography if you hadn't, you know, gone to sea?
I don't know if I would have found my grand passion, the thing that I needed to express, if I didn't go to sea.
The Steiger took the winter caretaking job 18 years ago. While daily chores occupy some of her time, clearing snow and checking the 20 or so buildings, she spends most of the day doing what she likes.
I call it mooning. You know, I just moon about. Someone once asked me, well, you know, aren't you out there taking pictures all the time? And I said, no, you know, I really need to just, you know, moon around. I need to sit for long periods of time and, you know, let my mind clear and just absorb the scene.
But when she finally does see something, the camera comes out.
I think for me, it's the scene itself that is important to me. And then with the photograph that I make of it, I only hope that I can do that justice.
So you're seeing it first with your eye?
Yeah. In my heart. If you have the great arch of the sky, you know, over a thing, you can see how small that thing is. And that's sort of one of my themes is I like that feeling of, you know, being tiny and feeling, you know, minuscule.
The more solitude, the greater the sky seems and the smaller she gets.
If I could have solitude and be with Brad at the same time, that's how I would improve it. But you can't, I could have one or the other.
With her naked eye, from her kitchen, the Steiger can see the mountain in Farmington, where she lives the rest of the year in a solar-powered cabin.
I'm a person I don't like as well on the mainland. But out here, it's almost like out here is when, you know, I'm a glass of water and I'm just filled right up. And then on the mainland, I spill it all out.
We go for a walk around the island, and I ask her if she's ever met anyone who needed as much solitude as she does.
My dad. He built a house on a mountain in Costa Rica. And his parents, actually, I just learned this. His parents moved to the desert, and they built this little house and out in the middle of nowhere. And that's where my dad grew up. And so I guess it runs in the family.
We hear the sound of Miss Julie's engine rumble to life, and we head for the boat and say our goodbyes and begin to watch each other disappear.
You wouldn't think that you could become more connected to the world you live in by being isolated on an island, but in fact, that's what happens.
The Steiger, a little dash now against the snow, gets smaller and smaller, alone once again on her island.
NHPR's Sean Hurley.
Before a fire. The pressure in my chest when you breathe in my ear. We both knew this would happen when you first appeared. My lady of the island.
If you look up New Hampshire's Star Island on a map, you'll see it with a handful of other islands. They make up what's known as the Isles of Shoals. There's a dotted line crossing those islands, the state border between New Hampshire and Maine. NHPR reporter Jason Moon found out that line has been the cause of some intense disagreement over the years.
I'm standing on the island of Newcastle right now, looking out at where the Piscataqua River meets the Atlantic Ocean. Across the river in front of me, I can see the state of Maine. And if I look way out to sea, I can just make out the Isles of Shoals. Now, between me and Maine, I can also see two lighthouses. One of them is on the island here with me. The other is a bit further out to sea.
That's the line we'd use, we'd probably use for a century or so. You know, between the New Hampshire and Maine fishermen.
That's Jack Newick, a lifelong lobsterman from Dover. Newick says in the old days, if you were out at sea, all you had to do was imagine a straight line connecting those lighthouses, and that was the border. They called it the Lights-On Range.
To think that in the early 70s, certain borders hadn't been established yet.
That's Roland Goodbody, an archivist at the Portsmouth Athenaeum. He says the Lights-On Range had no legal basis. It was more of a gentleman's agreement. That agreement fell apart in the 1970s with what became known as the Lobster War.
It seems to me, maybe I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me it could have been avoided entirely by Maine and New Hampshire agreeing on the same size lobster that you could catch.
In the late 60s, concerns about overfishing had led both states to enact minimum size restrictions on lobstering. But their minimum sizes were different.
by 1/16th of an inch. So suddenly it mattered to state officials where lobstermen set their traps. Newick, the New Hampshire lobsterman, remembers how the lobster war began.
For some reason, one particular Maine fisherman, he was a mean, ornery son of a gun. He called the state of Maine down to establish a line.
Maine game wardens responding to the call found a New Hampshire lobsterman named Ed Heafy with lobsters in his boat that were illegal in Maine. But Heafy, using the lights on range, said he wasn't in Maine, he was in New Hampshire. The wardens disagreed, things escalated. Ed Heafy's shipmate, Brocky, had a loaded pistol.
The wardens tried to board the boat. Eddie said, "You're not going to take my boat away from me." And Brocky's going, "Okay, Ed, you take care of those two. I got these two right in my sights right now, no problem."
Ultimately, no shots were fired that day, and Heafy went with the wardens. But when word of this standoff reached then-New Hampshire Governor Meldrum Thompson, the real action began. In 1973, Thompson had just taken office.
A badass in a really nice suit, you know?
Candace Thompson, no relation, covered Mel Thompson for several newspapers in the 1970s. Here's a quick highlight reel. Thompson lobbied for the New Hampshire National Guard to have nuclear weapons. He replaced the word scenic on the state license plate with live free or die. When a man with religious objections covered that phrase on his license plate, Governor Thompson put him in jail.
Mel liked a good fight. I mean, it was like he didn't. He did, you know? He did.
When this battle over state sovereignty broke out, Governor Thompson was quick to jump in.
Any dispute like this just kind of triggered this inner compulsion of his.
Tom Rath was an attorney in the Department of Justice under Thompson. He says in the long history of Thompson's fights, this one stands out.
You know, if you take some of the cases, they are probably just to the south of crazy. But this doesn't fall in that, in my judgment. It was and remains a legitimate question.
Thompson came out swinging. He sent his attorney general to personally defend the New Hampshire lobsterman, Ed Heafy, against the charges in a Maine court. In a speech, he called New Hampshire fishermen, quote, soldiers on an important battle line for the state. The dispute went to the Supreme Court, which passed it back to the states. And for all the tough talk, the two states did eventually agree, and they placed the border where it is today, north of the line claimed by Maine, but south of the lights-on range. To New Hampshire fishermen like Newick, it felt like a betrayal.
New Hampshire blew it, 1,700 acres.
Some New Hampshire fishermen never stopped fighting. Harrison Workman, a lobsterman who went by the nickname Worky, spent the rest of his life in search of historical evidence to back New Hampshire's claim to the old line. He even traveled to England and spent 9 days poring over colonial maps in the archives of the British Admiralty. Worky spoke to New Hampshire Public Television in 1982.
The boundary means so much to me, see, that I just cannot give it up. And a lot of people in Maine would wish I would, I suppose, but I'll never give it up as long as there's a ray of hope.
There was new hope in 2000 when another border dispute arose and the states went back to the Supreme Court. This time, the argument was over the ownership of the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. New Hampshire lawyers used Worky's maps and research to prepare their arguments. The court issued its ruling in 2001.
24 years ago, in a lobster fishing dispute between the two states, this court entered a consent judgment fixing the Maine-New Hampshire boundary in the coastal waters from Portsmouth.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, speaking for the court, said because of the way the two states settled the lobster war, New Hampshire was barred from making a claim on the shipyard. The state boundary was fixed. Except it might not be, or at least not entirely. Lobstermen will tell you there's good fishing on the far side of the Isles of Shoals. But after contacting half a dozen government agencies and consulting state statutes, the maps just aren't clear on where Maine's waters end and New Hampshire's begin out there. Which raises the possibility of yet another border dispute between the states.
I guess we've learned to live with that.
Again, Tom Rath.
There's some things the mind of man is not meant to know. And that line may be one of them.
One difference now, both states use the same minimum lobster size, 3 1/4 inches.
Oh, island in the sun.
NHPR's Jason Moon
ill to me by my father.
After the break, the story of an island with a controversial statue. Its origins date back 320 years, but the tensions it brings up have perhaps never been more relevant than today. This is NHPR. This is NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we are traveling the state, hearing stories of some of New Hampshire's islands. Over the past few weeks, there's been a lot of news about race and history, and what statues mean, what they represent. In New Hampshire, there's an island that is home to little else but a controversial statue. Reporter Jack Rodolico went to visit it for a story that originally aired on the podcast 99% Invisible.
So I'm down at the bottom of the hill away from the highway, and I'm about to cross a really old railroad bridge. It's not an active railroad anymore.
That's Jack Rodolico wandering around the New Hampshire woods.
It's a pretty view.
He's about 10 miles north of the state capital off of Interstate 93, in a pretty out-of-the-way place. There are no signs or markers on the road indicating something special is there, but he's found something.
So you get out to this little island, and the railroad tracks go straight across, but what you really notice is this epic-looking granite monument in the middle of the island.
It looks a lot like a monument you'd see in a city park, except it's on a forested island in the middle of a river.
It is enormous.
It's 30 feet tall.
Wow.
It's all granite, and on top of a tall pedestal, there's a woman.
She's wearing this gown that's falling off her shoulders. In her right hand, she has a tomahawk, and in her left hand, she has a fistful of scalps. And on the back of this thing, I'm going to run around to the back here, is the inscription.
Now, let's pause for just a second here. If you are a regular listener to the show, you know how I feel about plaques and always reading them. The reason being that plaques tell stories. Sometimes they tell really amazing stories, if you can decipher them.
March 15th to 30th, 1697. The war whoop, tomahawk, faggot, and infanticides were at Haverhill. The ashes of wigwam campfires at night and of 10 of the tribe are here.
I got nothing from that.
Yeah, not a lot of detail there. Honestly, the whole island was strange to me. Kind of creepy, actually. Not very well kept up. This enormous, imposing statue with the eerie plaque. The scalps? What's crazy is this statue was erected in 1874, making it the oldest monument dedicated to a woman in the U.S. So you'd think someone would come out here and at least mow the grass, you know? Well, what I learned is that plaque does tell a story, though not an obvious one. And I learned there's a good reason why the grounds are neglected. In fact, what to do with this historic site has become a bit of a problem. And it all has to do with the woman in the monument and what she did. The story starts about 50 miles south of the monument in a town called Haverhill, Massachusetts. I went down there and met up with a local historian named Tom Spitaleri in the parking lot of a Dunkin' Donuts. How you doing?
Good.
Jack.
Tom,
nice to meet you too. Tom is a die-hard New Englander. I'll tell you, he's wearing a Boston Red Sox jacket on top of a Boston Celtics jersey on top of a New England Patriots t-shirt.
The car's going to get a little noisy. It needs a lot of work.
Sure. And everywhere we drive in Haverhill, Tom sees signs of New England's past, particularly from colonial times.
Enter the time of Hannah Duston. During that time, we're embroiled in what some historians are now calling World War I. Most people would know it as the French-Indian War, or King Philip's, King George's, and the Seven Years' War.
In the 1600s, New England was a war zone between the French, the British, and the Native Americans. By the end of that century, disease and war would wipe out most Native Americans in the Northeast. And Haverhill was
the Wild West. I mean, it sounds funny, but putting it in today's context, that's what it was. We were the outpost. There was nothing north of us. That was it.
There was nothing but wilderness around, making it an easy target for attacks by Native Americans. Bands of Native Americans had shifting alliances with the British and the French. The French paid Abenakis to abduct Brits and bring them to Quebec. Then the French would sell these captives back to the British. It was a slave trade.
So, I mean, this area was constantly being raided. Constantly.
In 1697, a woman named Hannah Dustin was recovering from delivering her eighth child when Abenakis raided Haverhill. They killed and captured dozens of colonists and burned buildings.
That's what the word faggots on the monument refers to. A faggot was a bundle of sticks used to fuel a fire.
During the raid, Hannah Dustin's husband was outside with seven of their kids, defending the homestead and his children. But Abenakis entered the house and abducted Hannah, her newborn baby girl, and her nurse, Mary Neff.
The captives were marched north through the wilderness, and shortly after leaving Haverhill, when Hannah's baby wouldn't stop crying, one of the Abenakis smashed it against a tree. That's where you get the word infanticide from the monument's plaque. They kept walking north.
Most likely they were heading to the outpost of St. Francis.
That's up in Quebec. At some point, the war party handed Hannah Dustin and Mary Neff to another group of Abenakis, a group made up of a couple families.
She was sold to those Native Americans as a slave.
So the group of Abenakis that ended up with Hannah was made up of two fathers, two mothers, a grandmother, and a bunch of children. And they already had a white boy with them, a kid named Samuel Leonardson, who had been abducted from Worcester the previous year.
So that makes three white captives and 12 Abenakis. The whole crew crossed the Merrimack River to the island, the one that now has the monument on it, and they set up camp for the night.
In the middle of the night, Hannah Dustin made a decision. She rallied Mary and Samuel and led them around the sleeping Abenakis. One at a time, they brought a hatchet down on the Abenakis' heads. They killed 10 in total, two men, two women, six children. And then, before making their getaway, they scalped each victim.
Two Abenakis made it out alive, the old woman who was injured, and a little boy.
Hannah, Mary, and Samuel left the island in a canoe. It was a dangerous time of year to be on the river. It would have been choked with ice and full of rapids. They traveled at night to avoid being seen.
And 15 days after vanishing, Hannah Dustin and her companions landed in Haverhill, to the total shock of her husband, her seven children, and everyone who ever lost a family member to a raid. Hannah Dustin is the woman memorialized in the monument. The scalps she is holding in the statue belong to the 10 people, including six children, that she and her companions killed on the island.
And that statue isn't the only Hannah Dustin landmark in New England, not by a long shot. There are others, particularly in Haverhill, where she lived. Tom Spitaleri took me on a tour.
Let me just pull off here real quick. This is the Hannah Dustin rest area, named after her.
Is this the street here? I always forget.
Yeah, this is it here. Here's Hannah Dustin Street. The Hannah Dustin nursing home, obviously named after her. Now we're at the Hannah Dustin Rock. Monument Street got its name from the monument that's there for Hannah Dustin. Boscawen Avenue.
Boscawen is the town in New Hampshire where the island is. Tom even took me to an old garrison house, a fort essentially, where Hannah Dustin lived after her captivity.
We do private tours in here.
In a glass case is a piece of Hannah Dustin memorabilia I've seen on eBay. In the 1970s, the state of New Hampshire commissioned Jim Beam to make a Hannah Dustin whiskey decanter. It's an exact replica of the statue in New Hampshire, down to the little bloody scalps in her hand. It's made of porcelain.
Porcelain. Yeah, that hits the floor. Goodbye, good night.
It's kind of sexy and provocative, right? I mean, she's got cleavage popping out.
Yeah, that would never have happened back in 1697. But you got to remember, this was in 1976 they did this. 1976, it was about selling.
You're selling booze with a sexy woman with scalps and an axe in her hand.
Right, and we don't even know what she really looked like because there is no photographs of her.
That whiskey decanter is from 1976, but the New Hampshire Historical Society still sells a Hannah Dustin bobblehead in its museum shop. On the base of that bobblehead, it says, quote, "The Mother's Revenge." You can probably see how these kitschy collector's items might feel offensive. In fact, all the Hannah Dustin stuff and Hannah Dustin landmarks are a problem for some people who know the whole story. But the whole story, that's a tricky thing to pin down.
You got to understand something with the Hannah Dustin story. There's a lot of interpretation out there, and there's a lot of New England folklore.
Hannah Dustin's kidnapping and escape happened more than 300 years ago, and the story has been told and retold a lot. And actually, the reason we know anything about it today has to do with the fact that she scalped her victims.
After Hannah came home, her husband took her and all those Abenaki scalps down to Boston to sell them. Now, if you're like me, when you heard she had scalped her victims, you may have thought she had some kind of bloodlust. I thought scalping was something tribes did to white people, not the other way around. Turns out, I was very, very wrong.
Colonial governments paid cash for Native American scalps, heads, and even hands. They would pay most for a man, less for a woman, and least for a child. They would even pay Native Americans for the body parts of other Native Americans, depending on who was warring with whom at the time.
So Dustin had financial incentive for scalping her victims. But here's the reason we still know the story. When Hannah was in Boston selling her scalps, she sat down with Cotton Mather, and he wrote her story down. His name might ring a bell. Cotton Mather was head of the Protestant Church in New England. He had ties to the Salem witch trials, and he was a fire and brimstone minister who traveled around giving sermons.
These little frontier towns that Cotton Mather visited, they were filled with these shell-shocked colonists who had missing family members from Native American raids. Mather told Dustin's story again and again to rapt churchgoers, building Dustin's status as a heroine.
Well, I think the Hannah Dustin story has endured for so long because it's not just a story about a woman who killed people. It actually has become a story about the American nation at different points in time.
This is Barbara Cutter, historian and professor at the University of Northern Iowa.
It was a story about the colonial battle against Native Americans in the 17th century. It was a story justifying the westward expansion of the United States in the 19th century. And in more recent years, it has been used as a story domestically about culture wars, really.
Cutter has researched how and why the Hannah Dustin monuments were built. And she says it really hit home just how far the story had traveled when
I happened across a Salt Lake City Mormon woman's newspaper in the 1890s that started off by saying, "Who has not heard of Hannah Dustin?" I mean, Hannah Dustin was from Massachusetts.
After her captivity, Hannah Dustin lived in colonial obscurity. She actually had seven more kids and died at age 84.
No one talked about her through the 1700s. She was forgotten until
in the 18-teens and the 1820s, the United States was a new nation, and a lot of intellectuals at that point in time were trying to create a distinctly American culture. And so they started telling American stories and trying to uncover American heroes and heroines.
So the country's literary elite dug around for some good old American stories, and they found Hannah Dustin. Cutter says if you were an American in, say, 1865...
Well, the first place you might likely come across her would be when you opened your American history textbook in the school. You would also come across her story if you read famous American writers like Hawthorne.
Or John Greenleaf Whittier or Henry David Thoreau. Popular magazines, newspapers, essay collections, children's books, paintings. In the 1800s, Hannah Dustin was a household name.
Johnny Appleseed, Davy Crockett, Hannah Dustin.
But with each retelling of the story, something happened. People changed the narrative to suit their purposes.
It becomes a moral problem for Americans that Hannah Dustin killed children, especially since, I mean, they weren't just children, they were sleeping children.
Writers omitted details, embellished others, and sometimes just made things up. They completely left out the children she killed, replacing them with warriors. That Abenaki child that escaped, the writer said Dustin spared him intentionally, which there's no evidence of. Most writers depicted Hannah Dustin as a sympathetic heroine, this outraged mother seeking a justifiable revenge.
This was the era of manifest destiny, as in, it is America's destiny to inherit the land, to seize it from people dubbed heathens and savages.
That's when I think New Englanders really started focusing on Hannah Dustin more and more as the kind of heroine they should commemorate.
In the mid-1800s, as headlines screamed about the wars in the West, monuments sprung up in the Northeast. When the monument on the island was built in 1874, there were 1,000 people present. Again, it was the first monument ever built to a woman in the U.S., But when the Indian Wars died down around 1900, Hannah Duston dropped out of the national spotlight again.
But a subset of New Englanders held on to her story. In 1905, Hannah Duston's descendants created the Duston Family Association.
They sort of littered the landscape of Haverhill with memorial boulders and millstones in her honor, at sites where she landed her canoe, across from where she was buried. Apparently, they put one up at one place where she turned around and looked back, thinking that Indians might be following her on her way home.
Then all the way into the mid-1900s, there was a whole other layer of things named after those rocks and statues. A nursing home, a school, streets. Over time, the namings petered out, but the names themselves stuck. And so did the Duston family.
Well, my name is Cedric H. Duston, Jr. I'm the 10th generation from Hannah. So would that make her my 8th great-grandmother? I'm not sure. I just haven't counted.
Something like that, yeah.
Cedric is the vice president and formerly the president of the Duston Family Association. He's 88, and he's known about Hannah Duston since he was a boy. To Cedric, Hannah was a heroine.
She was concerned about her own life and those of her companions. And as such, I thought she was quite a lady to hatch the plan that she did and do the things she did. But basically, I think it was for self-preservation.
Just to make something clear, the Duston Family Association isn't lobbying for statues anymore. They mostly spend time tracing their lineage, and they get together for a barbecue every summer. And Cedric Duston says he understands why some aren't such a big fan of his grandmother 8 generations removed. But he is disappointed the statue and the island are in disrepair. Hannah's nose was shot off with a rifle, there's graffiti, and the grass hasn't been mowed in years.
When I was a young man, I could have gone up there and cut the whole thing, but right now, age won't let me do that. But I think the state of New Hampshire should make good use of the fact that they have in their confines the first statue ever erected to a woman in this country. Perhaps a new sign should be put at that location indicating that, as opposed to the sign that's there now indicating the deed that happened on that island.
So this is the island, huh?
This is the island.
I went back to the island with the 30-foot-tall Hannah Duston monument with someone who says he's avoided going out there for years.
She doesn't look very heroic. She looks more like an opportunist, angry opportunist that went back and then bragged about it and then history has become history.
This is Paul.
I'm Paul Puglio. I'm the Sagamore, which is roughly translated the principal speaker of the Grand Council of the Cossack Band of the Penacook and Abnaki people.
Paul doesn't buy Cotton Mather's version of the story, the one where the Abenaki smashed Duston's newborn baby against a tree. He says it doesn't mesh with other captivity stories of the era.
We have many, many accounts of captives saying that being taken by the Abnaki was not a death sentence. Many went to Canada. Some of them were traded back.
Paul thinks Hannah's captives were probably treating her well.
Well, presumably as well as one can be treated in captivity.
And he says Abenakis revered children, so the idea of a warrior bashing a baby against a tree, as Cotton Mather's story portrays, sounds unlikely to him.
It's impossible to know how the baby was killed or how Hannah Duston was treated by her captors. And I hesitate to judge from my 21st century vantage point what she should or shouldn't have done in order to make her escape. But it's clear that the Hannah Duston story is complicated.
Paul thinks the monument to her should just be forgotten.
I mean, I really don't think this monument should be preserved in any way. Just let it. It's going to last here for millennia, so it's unfortunate it's here. It's not going away.
And that's the problem now. The Hannah Duston monuments, the one on the island and all the others, are mostly fading relics and out-of-the-way places. But every few years, some politician or history buff or Native American points to one and says, tear this thing down or clean this thing up. And every time, people argue. Is she a heroine or is she a villain? The same thing over and over and over.
People are suggesting putting up additional plaques that show the Abenaki history, or changing the name from the Hannah Duston Memorial State Historic Site to the Contoocook Island State Historic Site.
But even something as small as cleaning up graffiti on the monument or mowing the grounds could be seen as taking a stance about whether Hannah Duston deserved a monument in the first place, about whether she was actually a hero or villain. Before we left the island, Paul Puglio said there was something he wanted to do off the record.
Sure, no recording? Okay.
He pulled out a drum and some tobacco. He paced around the monument twice. One time he scattered a little tobacco on four sides of the statue. The other time he beat the drum and sang. He didn't want me to record the ceremony, but he talked about it afterwards.
We don't want to forget our ancestors of the past. So we did a little honoring song, and we made an offering of tobacco to kind of purify the grounds where we were walking around there.
And does it provide you with any relief or satisfaction to do that?
Well, it's what is appropriate, you know, just asking our Earth Mother to, you know, honoring our Earth Mother, take them back, and understanding where there's some kind of closure there now.
Spiritual closure, if nothing else. In lieu of any public decision on how to include Paul's ancestors in this history, this private ceremony will have to be enough. For now, the statue, with her shot-off nose and vague, haunting plaque, remains neglected and crumbling, which actually is probably the most accurate symbol of how we feel about Hannah Duston today. Ambivalent about who she was, but not quite ready to let her go.
That story originally aired on the podcast 99% Invisible in 2014. It was produced by former NHPR reporter but always NHPR friend Jack Rodolico, along with Katie Mingle, Sam Greenspan, Avery Truffleman, and Roman Mars. Well, that's it for our island special. If you know a great island story or have photos from your favorite New Hampshire island, please email them our way, islands@nhpr.org. Thanks to our production team of Corey Princell, Todd Bookman, Michael Brindley, and Andrew Perella. NHPR's news director is Dan Barrick. The weekly New Hampshire News Roundup will be back next week. I'm Peter Biello. This is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
And a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries.
An island never cries.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.